Sometimes in the pursuit of science, we're so interested in getting an interesting result that we forget that the participants that we have help us are people as well. And it is this problem that we are trying to overcome when we go through an ethics review process. So today I'll be talking about ethics in user research and how this relates to human-computer interaction research. Next slide. In academic settings, we have ethical oversight of the research that we do, particularly research that involves humans or animals or biological samples. In Canada, this is done by what are called research ethics boards. In the US, these are called institutional review boards, but they're essentially the same thing. At the University of Calgary, this is known as the Conjoint Faculty Research Ethics Board. They have a partner board called the Conjoint Health Research Ethics Board, I think. For our purposes in HCI, we're primarily concerned with working with the CFREB. And the role of the Research Ethics Board or the Institutional Review Board is to essentially balance participants' rights, i.e. the risks that our research has on them, with the goals of the research, i.e. the benefits. And so they really act as a participant's advocate in terms of helping us to plan effective research strategies, effective research designs, and that sort of stuff. Something that you might have heard is that each time you plan on running a user study, you need to actually prepare an ethics application and send it off to this research ethics board and have the ethics board actually okay the research plan that you have. This is, in fact, true. And the purpose is to make sure that we are respecting participants' rights and that we are essentially doing research that is worthwhile doing in terms of the risk that it poses onto our participants. If you think about that, what it means is a research ethics board is actually somebody or a group of people that are trying to help you ensure that the research you're doing is worthwhile. It is, in fact, unethical to perform research when there is no benefit at all, because it is actually a waste of participants' time. Next slide. So a question you might ask is, okay, well, what constitutes ethical then? So the TCPS2, which is the Tri-Council Policy Statement on Ethics, provides a simple framework, I think, that can, to me, be boiled down to three essential guidelines. Now, this is a nice little document that you can download and read. There's a link at the very end of this podcast. But it basically boils down to three guidelines. The first is respect for people. The second is concern for welfare. And three is justice. The way I think about each of these guidelines is that respect for persons is about respecting the autonomy of the participants. That is, that we respect them as people, that we respect them as people that can make sound judgments, and we essentially want them to be informed about what it is that they're planning on doing, or what it is that we plan on having them do. And so we respect their ability to make those judgments and decisions. If we take away that ability for them to make those decisions, then there needs to be a very good reason for that. The second is concern for welfare. And so essentially what this typically refers to is quality of life. So suppose we had an experiment where we, maimed them somehow, broke a knee or something like that. That would be, probably not very good against this guideline. Typically, of course, in HCI, we are not doing that. We're doing other things. We're making them use interfaces and having them find problems for us. Well, one of the things here is, do they feel good about themselves afterwards? If you were using an interface for a long time and you were failing a bunch of times, this would cause you stress. You wouldn't feel very good about yourself. And that is actually a quality of life issue as well. The third guideline is about justice. And typically the way I think about this is that this is about vulnerability and the burden of participation. So you may be designing technologies, you may be running user studies with people that are of a vulnerable population. This may mean that people that don't have the ability or the choice to make decisions about whether they participate or not. Well, this is problematic in ethics and in an ethical term. So next slide. What I want to do today then is really cover four things or so. The first is I want to talk about some motivation or why it is that we actually have these research ethics boards. Essentially some lessons from the past that provide us with some pretty interesting insight actually into the thought processes that informed the TCPS too. The second is I want to talk about ethics in an HCI context. So this is more in terms of what we need to be concerned with ourselves. The third thing is I want to talk about what it is that we need to do as HCI researchers in terms of putting together an ethics application and what it is that the Research Ethics Board is actually looking for. And then the fourth thing I'll talk about is I'll give you a quick inside look at what the CFREB is actually doing when it is that you send them an application. Next slide. Okay, so some motivation. So I'll be talking about three experiments that happened in the past. There are a lot more than these that actually have happened, but these I think are really interesting because they border on that that delicate balance of research needs as well as risks for participants. Milgram's experiments on obedience, the Tuskegee syphilis study, and the Stanford prison experiment. Next slide. So Milgram's obedience, Milgram's studies on obedience to authority, these studies were set up as follows. So the participant is actually somebody that we call the teacher. So there are three people involved here. EU stands for the experimenter, T stands for the teacher, and this is the actual participant, and L is the learner. Now, it's important to note that the experimenter is actually the experimenter, of course. The participant is the teacher, and the learner, this is what we call a confederate, so somebody who's in on the study, and they are not real participants. And what happens here is that the teacher is supposed to give lessons or tests to the learner, and if the learner gets it wrong, then the teacher is supposed to administer an increasing level of shock. If the teacher kind of turns and asks the experimenter if it's okay, the experimenter has a very basic script, and essentially the experimenter says, you must continue the experiment. The experiment requires you that you continue, so on and so forth. And if you take a look at the next slide, you can actually see what this machine actually looked like. And you can actually see on a little zoom in here, you can see that actually at fairly at the high end of the machine there, you've got intense shock, extreme intensity shock, danger, severe shock. And what would happen was that these participants, as they would go, the learner would eventually stop responding. So the learner would say things like, "Hey, stop! That hurts." Or like, ow, 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 that hurts. That hurts a lot. Ow, ow, ow. And eventually the learner would just stop responding altogether. And so it's important to note that the teacher and the learner can't actually see each other, but the teacher can hear the learner. And if you think about what happened here, as a participant, you are essentially, for all you know, you have essentially killed somebody, right? Or hurt them, at least fairly severely. In terms of the research outcome, the idea was that we would be able to determine whether or not people kind of felt like they were absolved of blame if somebody was telling them what to do. And it turns out that, in fact, this was the case. Many of the teachers actually went to the most extreme parts of that machine before they actually stopped altogether, and most of them didn't. So obviously this is absolutely crazy. Another study to talk about is the Stanford Prison Experiment. So the Stanford Prison Experiment, this was done sometime, I think, in the late 50s or the early 60s. The Milgram Experiment, I think, was also done in the late 50s, early 60s. Anyway, in the Stanford Prison Experiment, there were 70 students, and they were recruited essentially out of a newspaper ad. 24 of them were assigned randomly as prison guards, They were told in the recruitment that the study would run 7 to 14 days and that they'd be paid $15 an hour. So what happened was, you know, these students would see, actually 24 of them were assigned randomly as prison guards, and the remaining students were actually sort of arrested at home, and they would be brought in to the university after having been booked in a police station. And so the idea was to understand and explore the psychology of what it was like to be a prisoner and the psychology of what it was like to be a prison guard. And so the manipulation was essentially that these prisoners were brought in. You can see that they had paper bags placed over their heads. Their individuality was stripped from them, so they were to wear these little sort of smocks that would take away kind of any sight of their hair. They were assigned these white prison garb shirts that had a prison number on it. And the prison guards were essentially told to keep order. They weren't allowed to actually attack any of the prisoners, but they were told to take whatever measures were necessary to keep order in the prison. And the prison was actually converted the bottom two floors of the psychology department. And so there were cells that the prisoners could be placed into. And essentially the experimenter, you know, let these guards loose. And so what they ended up seeing was that guards enforced authoritarian measures and subjected participants to actual psychological torture. Prisoners came to passively accept the abuse and helped to harass other prisoners to prevent it. Two participants actually ended up quitting early, and the entire experiment was stopped after 6 days. Some of the interesting things that happened, next slide, were on day two, the prisoners took off their stocking caps, they blockaded the cell door, trying to prevent the guards from actually coming in. Some things that actually happened were that the mattresses ended up being a luxury item, and actually the guards would take out the mattresses if the prisoners were misbehaving. The guards would line the prisoners up kind of randomly every once in a while and force them to recite their prison number or their prisoner numbers. When the prisoners became somewhat rowdy, the guards volunteered to work extra hours and actually attacked the prisoners with fire extinguishers. So they didn't actually physically attack them, but I think they shot the fire extinguishers at them. There was the prison guards made a privilege cell. So people in this cell were given better food and the mattresses. There was also harassment in the form of forcing these prisoners to undergo extra exercise sessions. And the sanitation went down the tube. So the guards actually made the prisoners use buckets and wouldn't allow them to empty the buckets. And over time, the guards became exceedingly sadistic. The guards were actually fairly unhappy that the experiment ended early. So obviously, yet another insane experiment. Next slide. So the last example I want to talk about is the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. And this was essentially an experiment where they went into a very poor area of the United States called Tuskegee. And the goal was essentially to watch what happens when people suffer from syphilis, to understand what the outcomes are for people that have syphilis. And so they went into a poor neighborhood. They told them that they had bad blood, and I think they may have faked some treatments. I don't think I'm making that up. And they did this even when a real treatment was available. So I think they didn't even end this experiment until the mid-70s. So it kind of went on for quite some time. So it was a long-term study. So if you go on to the next slide, obviously these things are somewhat kind of horrible to think about in terms of the psychological and the physical stresses that the participants went through. But articulated, you can actually see that there's a bunch of different things going on. One is that the risk to participants tended to outweigh the benefit. So this includes both physical risks, as in the syphilis experiment, as well as emotional risks. So if you think about what the participants had to go through in the Stanford Prison Experiment or in the obedience study, you know, where they imagined or where they actually saw themselves potentially killing somebody, right? There's also deception involved here. So in the syphilis experiment, for sure, there's deception involved in terms of whether there's actually a treatment available. In the obedience study, there's also deception involved here. And particularly when there isn't a proper debriefing procedure, this is considered a really bad thing. In the syphilis experiment, you also see that people are actually taking advantage of fairly poor people. And this is an example of what I mean when I say that these are a vulnerable population. And you have essentially taken away their right to make decisions. And this is interesting because we also, in this situation, this violates the principle of justice, right? So these poor people bear the brunt of having to kind of be in this experiment, but they get none of the benefits. And that's ethically a bad thing as well. In principle, I don't think this happened in either one of these studies, but if you reveal the identity of participants, this is also considered a bad thing. So participants are generally considered given the ability to be to have confidential participation and that their participation is anonymous. So in the next slide, so obviously you're kind of, well, not obviously necessarily, but you're probably looking at this and thinking, well, I'm not going to do anything kind of that crazy, right? I'm not going to do manipulations that are that insane. I'm primarily going to give people different interfaces to try different tasks, and I want to see how they do with the interfaces. And this is fine. This is kind of fairly standard, typical practice in human-computer interaction research. Or you may be doing some interviews about kind of their knowledge or their understanding of a domain to help you inform the design of some tool, right? So this is all fine and great. And this is what ethics, an ethical procedure constitutes in HCI, is constituted of in HCI. So to deal with guideline one, the way you need to do it is to ensure that your participants have full informed, are giving you full informed consent about the procedures that they're about to undertake and the purpose of your research, right? You also want to make sure that you are not wasting their time. So if you respect them as people, you don't waste their time. The way I think about this is if it was, you know, somebody that you respected, say it's Bill Gates or the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Canada, whatever it is, and you were respectful of them, what is it that you would do in your study, right? So obviously don't waste your time. Obviously make sure that they're informed and understand what they're getting themselves into. Second guideline is concern for welfare. So concern for the welfare of your participants, right? One of the big things is ensuring that their participation is confidential and anonymous, right? So in our context, there may be reasons why their participation is considered a risk to them. And so we need to ensure that their identity is never revealed. Suppose one of your participants does really poorly with the interfaces. We would never identify them by name in a research study. You want to ensure that your participants are not demeaned as a result of their participation. This means both in terms of social pressures from the outside and also feelings on their own part. So they may actually feel very stressed or embarrassed by their performance with a particular tool. And so this is dealing with concern for them afterwards, after the study. Beyond this, we also need to be concerned about whether they're feeling inadequate or stressed out during the study, right? Because typically what we do is we give them interfaces that are broken in some way, and we need to ensure that they understand that this is not evaluating them, but the interface itself. The third guideline is justice, and the way I think about it primarily in HCI research is that sometimes we are designing for or with vulnerable populations, people that need assistive technologies, children perhaps that are not in a position where they can provide informed consent, or older participants, right? Your older population. So we need to ensure that we are treating these people fairly and that they are not simply taking on the burden of participation because they are a vulnerable population. Next slide. So I think the thing to remember is that often we are giving people kind of, half-broken tools, right, or half-broken prototypes to play with. And testing can therefore be a fairly distressing experience. There's a pressure to perform. We, participants understand that, they're being asked to do something and trying to do it well. So often they may feel feelings of inadequacy. And I think that it's important during studies to essentially remind them that we are testing the interface and not the participants themselves. And so the way to think about this is the golden rule, right? Subjects should always be treated with respect. Treat them the way that you would expect to be treated yourself, or the best person that you know in terms of how you would treat them. So when it comes to these things, the way to think about ethics, there's three phases. One is in terms of being prepared before the study. Two is acting in an ethical way during the study. And then three, obviously, debriefing your participants in a way that is ethical. Next slide. So before the test, don't waste the participants' time. Make sure that you've debugged your experiments. Make sure you've figured out your scripts. Make sure you've have everything to go and ready before your user actually shows up. So have the materials all printed, lined up, everything's ready to go. Make the users feel comfortable, right? Emphasize that the system is the thing that's being tested, not them. Let them know that they can stop at any time so that they have the right. And that informed consent is a process, right? So although they provide you with consent early on to start, they may decide partway through the process that actually they don't want to continue anymore and that they are allowed to cease the experiment at any time. Acknowledge that the software may have problems. They are using prototype software, and so it may break on them. You should let them know that this is going to be the case. You need to tell your participants that you will maintain their privacy and that the test results will be kept completely confidential. And then you need to explain to them what has actually happened, what is the process that you're going to undertake, what is the procedures that they're going to do, what is perhaps the purpose of the study. You want to do this in such a way that it doesn't necessarily reveal any sort of bias, but this is something that is only fair to do for your participants. A reasonable thing to do is also to ask if they have any questions about the procedure before they begin. This is part of respecting their autonomy. Again, only use volunteers, and you want to avoid situations where your recruitment could be considered as coercion. So, for example, as a professor, it is difficult/impossible/ I should never ask my students to participate in studies that I design, because my students will feel some kind of obligation towards me, right? In the same way, we should be very careful about asking our friends. Generally, these requests should be done in a way that is not directed at specific or targeted individuals, okay? So that people are actually volunteering their time rather than being asked and feeling undue pressure to participate. When you're actually doing the test, again, make sure that you're not wasting your participants' time, right? Never have them perform unnecessary tasks. Never have them answer questions that you aren't planning on using. While they're actually performing the tests, make sure that the users are actually comfortable, right? Try to give them early success early on to make them feel good about themselves. Keep it relaxed in the room, right? Give them coffee breaks if the study is going on for a long time, right? Hand out test tasks one at a time so they're not feeling over like an undue level of stress. Right. Never indicate displeasure when somebody does something incorrectly. Avoid disruptions when they're actually doing it. And monitor your participants. So if they're starting to, behave or exhibit signs that they're, feeling stressed out or things are becoming unpleasant, then you should stop the study altogether. Right? Maintain the privacy. This is an interesting one, right? So do not allow the user's management to observe the test. So if you worked for a company and you were brought in to do a user study, you wouldn't want your boss to be watching you, right? That'd be fairly stressful. In the same way, your participants, if we are protecting their privacy, we want to make sure that there aren't random people kind of observing what the participants are doing. That's a bad thing. Next slide. So finally, after the tests, make sure that you always tell your participants that they've helped you in some way and to help you find areas for improvement for your prototype or your research question or whatever it might be. inform the user at the very end of everything that is happening. So if you have hypotheses, you want to tell them what it is that your hypothesis was, what you expected to see, right? You can answer the questions that would have biased the results earlier on if you'd answer them, but you can answer them now. And then finally, you want to make sure that you're maintaining their privacy. So you never report results in a way that the individual users can be identified. Right? If you are collecting video or you're collecting photos, you want to make sure you have permission to use those in presentations later on. So this is how we essentially ensure that the procedures that we do are ethical in an HCI context. In terms of what you need to do at the University of Calgary, next slide, you primarily have to be concerned with an ethics application. The processes kind of vary a little bit depending on the university or granting agency or industry, where you are. The processes are fairly similar. They vary a little bit, but they're fairly similar. At the University of Calgary, we use a system called IRIS to handle this. And the reason we do this is to make sure that the academic organization and the granting agency can be sure that the procedures that we're doing have been vetted essentially by a community of researchers, as well as the broader community, to make sure that actually the procedures are in fact ethical. So if you were to go to this website, iris.ucalgary.ca, you can actually go ahead and create an ethics application and fill it out. For the purpose of this class, we have a paper version of this, which is a slightly older version of it, but it contains mainly the same fields. So I'll just talk about kind of the major sections and talk about the things that you need to fill in. Next slide. So the first section is the applicant. The principal investigator is the applicant, and this is usually your supervisor. co-applicants are other people involved in the research. You are a co-applicant. Second slide, project details. So you want to have a title that is short but meaningful. You also want to indicate which agencies directly fund the specific project. The reason is because different agencies may have different reporting requirements. Finally, a list of locations where your data will be collected. So you have to know where you are actually going to be running your study. And you can see that now that there are some aspects of this ethics application that involve planning. So you want to be able to say, this is where I'm going to be collecting my data. The reason why they're asking for the location is because depending on the location, there may be slightly different requirements. So let's suppose I was doing a research study where I was collecting data in, let's say Nepal, right? If I was doing this, then not only would I want to make sure that my procedures were considered as ethical at the University of Calgary, because I'm considered a University of Calgary researcher, I would also want to make sure that the research procedures that I'm undertaking are ethical in the local context. So just because we consider something to be ethical here does not necessarily mean that it's going to be considered ethical over there. And so typically what a research ethics board is going to require in that circumstance is for you to provide an ethics research board over in Nepal to essentially go through your application and vet it as well. In a typical case, particularly in HCI research, most of this is going to happen on campus. But when it goes off of campus, then we need to be a little bit more concerned about, you know, whether this is a public space or it's actually a private space, and who do we get permission to actually conduct this research from. Next slide. So more project details. You're also asked to provide a summary. What is the purpose of your study? What are your objectives? What is the method? And you want to provide very clear and detailed articulation of what it is that you're going to do and what is actually required of the participants. The next bit is in an appendix, you also want to include the questionnaires. So what are the questions that you're actually going to ask your participants? If you're having them fill out a survey, you would want to provide a sample of what that survey is going to look like. If there are test instruments that you're planning on using, you want to include samples of this so that the review board can actually take a look at these things and ensure that it actually looks reasonable. Next slide. You also need to provide details about how you recruit participants. So I told you in the past that, or earlier on, that we need to be careful about how we recruit in such a way that we can ensure that the people are participating of their own free will, right? So if I am trying to recruit participants from my classes, then this is easily considered as coercion because students do not necessarily feel that they can say no to me, right? So you want to talk about who it is that you're trying to recruit, who it is that you are excluding from your recruitment, remuneration. So are you providing them with food, money, whatever? How you're actually going to do the recruitment, whether you're doing it through posters, email, snowball sampling, whatever it might be. If you're recruiting through posters and email, then you need to provide a sample of this so they can see that the wording is actually consistent with what they expect. Next slide. One of the things that you need to include is how you're going to collect informed consent. Typically, there is a standard sort of form that you can fill out. And in that form, what you would describe is what the participants are actually going to go through. And this is the thing that your participants actually sign. Normally, what you actually have them do is, next slide, normally what you would have them do, your participants do, is actually go through that informed consent form with you. And you can actually explain to them the crucial pieces. That is, that they can cease their participation at any time. That is, that you explain to them what is actually happening in the study, how they will be remunerated, whether there are any risks to them, right? The content of this includes who you are, the researchers, the university ethics contact, if they have complaints, the purpose of this study, what they're expected to do, and so forth. It should also, next slide, it should also talk about what kind of data is being collected, how the data will be used, so you want to also tell them that they're data, they will be considered anonymous, their participation will be kept confidential, and what safeguards you are going to put in place for data security. Finally, you may ask them for specific permissions. So you may ask, for example, that you take their photo of them using their system somehow, or you take a videotape somehow, and you want to be very clear about how you're going to use their images. Next slide, again, the risks that they're going to be that the participants are going to be subjected to, and that they have a right to withdraw at any time. So these aspects of informed consent are the key pieces that need to be in that form. Next slide. One of the things that the application is going to ask you is how are you going to maintain the privacy, confidentiality, and anonymity of your participants. So usually you need to talk about how you're going to handle the raw data, and how you're going to deal with it, who has access to it. Next slide, you're going to actually have to talk about how you're going to process the data, and in particular, usually this is reported in an anonymous aggregate form. If you're reporting on particular individuals, use pseudonyms. Next slide, you need to estimate the risks that your participants are going to undergo here, whatever that may be, if they're going to potentially feel some stress, or if you're testing some sort of mobile interface and you want to have them walk around, well, they could trip on something, so how are you going to handle that, right? Is there any deception involved? Is there any going to be any information that is withheld for the informed consent process, right? Is there any social risk? Could they be potentially embarrassed by other people knowing that they're participating? These kinds of things. Next slide. So one of the things, obviously, is you're going to need to also talk about the benefits. Benefits to you as a researcher, but also to the participant, perhaps, if they are going to experience any benefits. To the research community, that's a possibility. Or to society as a whole, right? How is society going to benefit from your work? And an interesting point here that has been made many times is actually, if there's no clear benefit to doing the research, then you are wasting people's time, and this is considered unethical. So I've talked a lot about the process in terms of kind of going through and filling out an ethics application at the University of Calgary. I want to give you kind of an inside look at how the CFREB works. I have served as a member for about a year at this point, and I've seen a lot of ethics applications come through. For the most part, we basically never see, as a board, we never see applications that come through from computer science. This is because the board meets primarily about applications that we that the chair deems as having undue risk to the participants, or there are some problems with the applications. Typically, what will happen with an application is that your application will go in. It is reviewed and vetted by first an ethics resource officer, somebody who is experienced in looking at these things, and they will basically give you a list of tiny little fixes that you need to make. And then if it is a little bit more tricky, it might be vetted by a reviewer, a member of the board. It might be reviewed by the chair. And assuming that everything goes okay, then you are given a check mark and you're good to go. This entire process takes between 2 and 4 weeks, depending on the load on the board, or on the the review board. When the entire board meets, this is when there are applications that we perceive as having undue risk to the participants. And undue risk is kind of this moving target a little bit. But typically, if you are involving children somehow, vulnerable populations, such as the disabled, or say prisoners somehow, or your study involves deception somehow, these are things that are flagged by the chair, and they come to a full board review. The full board is comprised of somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 academic members, as well as a few members from the community. Community being people outside of the university. And this is actually really important because we need to make sure that the academic members of the community, or the academic members, aren't simply sort of doing a groupthink thing where they're like, oh yeah, this seems fine, this seems fine. The purpose of having community members on the board is to ensure that we are meeting standards that a typical person off the street would actually have. These people that we recruit are, from the community are typically people that have served somehow. So right now we have people that have served on the United Way board, but they're really just kind of like regular people that are not academics. What typically happens is we then review the application and find where each of us has some concerns, and then we bring the researchers in, and we actually have a discussion with them about our concerns, and we talk about possible solutions to address those concerns. Typical things that happen are, we're not really sure what this, typical things that may happen would be, we don't know what this questionnaire that you're administering is, or what it does, or it's asking something that's particularly sensitive, and it's not necessary to actually ask that question. We think that, the procedures place undue risk on the participants in terms of their participation. That is, that their confidentiality might be compromised somehow because other people might see them participating, and it's not a good thing. So these are the things that the review board looks at in a full board review. Typically what happens after this is that the researcher goes back with a list of concerns, they fix their application, and then we never see them again. So this is typically how the review process actually works at the University of Calgary. For the most part, in HCI research, this is something that we don't really have to concern ourselves with. So that's a good thing. All right, so next slide. You now know ethics is required to protect participant rights. Ethics in research is not optional, particularly if we're doing any sort of user studies that involve people. And you can also see that ethics applications requires planning. Actually, to me, filling out the ethics application is the planning, right? Figuring out what it is that you're going to have people do, even more so than the proposals that you write. So in a proposal, you're kind of waving your hands a little bit about what it is that you're going to do. But in an ethics application, you actually need to spell out what the exact procedures are so that people can actually vet it. And it forces you to think about what the steps are that you're going to take in your process and how you're going to achieve your research goals. All right, so a couple of links to finish off. So this is homework, not really, but you can actually read the Tri-Council Policy Statement on Ethical Conduct for Research Involving Humans. It's about a 200-page document. It's good to read on the bathroom. And then some primary sources that you can actually check out after that. Some interesting stuff. Thank you very much.